My name is Paul. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I'm from San Francisco. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak. Abstinence through the holidays. You know, when I first heard the topic, I thought it was like a trick question. You know, like abstinence through the holidays as opposed to abstinence today or yesterday. You know what I mean? It didn't make, it sort of computed, but it didn't. Because I remember, vital statistics, I guess. I came into program August 5th, 1983, and I got abstinent May 7th, 1986. And so you can see it took a little bit of time to catch it. I'm coming into my 22nd abstinent cycle through the holidays, and I'm keeping 120 pounds off. Yeah, the number's not so important, I guess, is that it's a normal weight, and I'll get into it in the talking. In the beginning, I was concerned about being abstinent through the holidays. Actually, when I first came in, I didn't realize that abstinence through the holidays was a difficult thing. It was only by being in the rooms and hearing people say, you know, I'm going home on Thanksgiving and I'm worried. And I was, whoa, what are you worried about, you know? And, you know, because I didn't understand, because I wasn't abstinent or trying to hang abstinence through the holidays. And then I understood there were things that I had to come up with, some action that I had to take, which was have an escape plan. If I was going home, I had to be able to get out of there when I had to. I had to know what my food was going to be like, where I was going to get it. I had to know where the meetings were. I had to be able to call my sponsor. And it was just sort of, it's a logistics kind of a thing, you know, just planning ahead. And I think actually the biggest help in dealing with it was knowing that there's a transition coming into the holidays, and then there's a transition coming out of the holidays. And that just because I was abstinent through the holiday itself didn't mean I was going to feel good 2 days later. You know, that maybe it was going to be a ripple effect. And I was never in touch with my feelings, so it might be a week before I would get in touch with, I feel kind of bad about that, you know. Now I'm better. I can feel bad a lot quicker. And I've got this program to thank for that. You know? So for me, speaking here is just emphasizing what it takes to be abstinent on a daily basis. You know, sometimes I think, like, if you only listen to how it works, you wouldn't have to hear me, you know? Or, I mean, it's about, for me, it was, well, I'll just tell my story and the stuff will weave through it, I guess. I grew up always heavy, always concerned about my weight. I was an obese person my whole life. Except for the times that I went on diets. And I went on some pretty severe diets. The most severe was actually the one I lost my... that I got this abstinence. But the one before that was eating 350 calories a day, running 5 miles in the morning, 5 miles at night, and lifting weights every other day. And I only stopped that because I coughed blood up one day. I slept 14 hours a day, and I flunked out of school that semester because I was tired all the time. But I did have a 32-inch waist, a 48-inch chest, and I felt fat. You know, it didn't matter because I could pinch a little bit of this, you know, and sanity wasn't necessarily thinness, and I learned that years before I came into program. So, grew up, the way I looked at it was that there was something wrong with me. My father ran a factory, 100 people in it. It was his job to see what wasn't going right and fix it. And then he would come home and he would look around the house, see what wasn't right and needed fixing, and it was usually me. Mm-hmm. And I got the sense that there was something wrong with me. And, you know, it wasn't, yeah, I was broke. And at the same time, my family was sort of, either my family was in the closet or the rest of the family was in the closet. Because I have first cousins, I don't know their names, I don't know where they live, I don't know how many kids they have. It was a very cloistered kind of existence. Man, I didn't think I'd be this nervous. Anyway, I was always concerned with how much I weighed, what clothes I could get into, when I was going to get something to eat. When I was a kid, I was, you know, I didn't have a voice or a vote in my house. It was my way or the highway is what I was told. And I was also told that when I got out that I would be the head of the household and it would be my way, you know. And but no one told my first wife that. You know? I learned a lot of things that weren't really helpful, you know. I learned that we don't talk about our feelings, particularly to people, well, not particularly to people outside the family, but we just don't talk about our feelings. I remember when my brother and I were smaller, my brother, who's younger than me, he asked my mother to talk to us like we were strangers. He said, talk to me like I'm a stranger, you know, because she was always nice to strangers, you know. She, but with us, I guess if you love somebody enough, you can be more abusive, I guess. It was strange. It was. Anyway, I'm Jewish, so I also grew up feeling different than other people. I think a lot of us feel different for different reasons. I remember speaking in front of the first gay, lesbian, transgender meeting in San Francisco. The first time I spoke there, I sat in the parking lot wondering why they asked me to speak, because I can't, you know, I'm straight, so I don't relate to the focus necessarily. And I got an epiphany in the parking lot. I said, they think they're different because they're gay. I think I'm different because I'm Jewish. Women think they're different because they're women. All different reasons, but we're all alike. We think we're different just for a different reason, you know. Anyway, but getting back, I was working, I don't want to spend too much time on what it's like. So I was fat and unhappy, that's basically it. And I felt like I was a metaphysical alien. I grew up, I sang in the school choir. I was the soprano lead for Good King Wenceslas. I'm Jewish. You know? I just didn't fit, you know. I mean, I didn't identify, I didn't fit in. My family didn't, I didn't have a family that was together. There was something wrong. There was just always something wrong, and I was looking for the answer. And when I was young, I figured that my religion might have the answer, you know, because I felt broken, and I thought that religion was going to fix me. And I figured, you know, my parents were pretty smart. My grandparents were smart, and they didn't convert. And so I figured there must be something really good about being Jewish that I just haven't been exposed to. So it must be pretty strong, or my family wouldn't have held on to it. So I started studying my religion, and what happened for me was that I got somewhat knowledgeable about it. And if you wanted to talk comparative religion, I'd ram it down your throat. You know, I was a pretty angry person, and and the Holocaust was hard for me to deal with. So was the Inquisition and the Crusades and the pogroms. But the Holocaust was in my... I was born during that time. And I remember, you know... So anyway, I was angry with God. Great. So it works out that I get a job in Madrid, Spain. My dream job. A 3-year tour. And... I hired a fellow. I was working for a large company. I ran a small office. I hired a recovering alcoholic who happened to be an electrician. We were doing construction. And I didn't hire him because he was a recovering alcoholic. I hired him because he was an electrician. And but as soon as he got there, I could see he had what I wanted. I studied with rabbis 3-4 days a week. That's what I did for 10 years before I came to program, and trying to find the truth of the universe so I could fix myself. And this fellow had what I wanted. And I, after a week of working with him, I said, "What kind of a spiritual path are you following?" And he said, "I'm following the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I had never heard of a 12-step program, so he gave me a big book, and a 12 and 12. And this was August of 83, so my family had left just before he got there to set up for the school year in September. And I was staying through the end of, I was staying another 8 months. And what happened was, what he had was that he could say no without yelling. He talked about God a lot. And he seemed to be like a, he could sense when people weren't, were in pain, and he could reach out to them and make them feel better. It was just a natural thing. It's pretty amazing. And it wasn't until later that I came to understand that that's really steps 10, 11, and 12, is to be able to get in touch with what's going on. 11 with God, service is 12. And so I was pretty lucky. My sponsor worked for me. We did our work in an hour and a half during the day, and we spoke program 6.5 hours a day. My family was gone, so I'd go to his house every evening and have dinner. And his wife, who was a battered woman from a previous alcoholic marriage, she shared what it was like to be a battered woman. And he shared what it was like to be in mental institutions, in jail, lose your family, sleeping in Hotel Honda. You know those first Hondas that came out? Well, that was his home while he was drunk, right? And he would tell me, you know, when he got sober, he could move into a basement-level apartment. If the window was open and the sprinkler was on, his face would get wet, right? And I could see that his life had changed because of the program, and that it gave me a willingness to follow the 12 steps and 12 traditions. We did a drug and alcohol inventory right away. I'm an alcoholic. I was a periodic. I drink maybe 4 or 5 times a year, and every time I'd get drunk. But I knew that, you know, be it a bar mitzvah or a wedding where, you know, the liquor was free. And I just knew that I wasn't driving, and when I came home, you know, the next day I'd wake up in my bed, but with my clothes on, you know, it's just... but I realized from doing an inventory that, hey, that's an alcoholic. You know, I drink like an alcoholic. I didn't think I was a drug addict, even though I smoked marijuana for 20 years. I stopped smoking before I went to Spain, because in 83, I don't know what it's like now, you were in big trouble if you smoked dope and got caught in Spain. So I didn't smoke for 3 years, didn't think about it for 3 years. And I said, well, then I'm not an addict. An addict needs his stuff, right? And thinks about it all the time, at least, even if he doesn't get it. Anyway, to make a long story short, you know, he had told me that if I'm using anything to change my mood, that I'm not clean and sober. And when I took my first toke when I got back to the States, I realized my mood changed, and I haven't had pot from early 84 or any drugs. But so he taught me a lot of things that were really helpful. You know, one of the things was that we have a disease, but it comes out in many different ways. And it isn't just about not drinking or not using drugs, but it's about not spending in a way that changes our mood. It's about not using sex in a way that changes our feelings. It's about not gambling. It's about not working like a workaholic. It's a lot of things. And drummed into my head that I had to be vigilant. That I, you know, if I was going to stop one thing, I had to make sure that I wasn't going to pick up another. And And that became really evident to me when I got down to goal weight and I started looking around dating-wise. You know, that was kind of interesting. I was divorced and just check my time here. Doing okay? Okay. Thank you. Okay, yes. He told me it was an action program. It's an action program. And he ran me through the steps right away. I think in AA they don't take as long going through the steps. I don't go to AA much except if I'm traveling, can't find an OA meeting. But right through the steps. And he could tell, you know, I was in Madrid, like I say, you know, and I take the train in from, I lived in one part of the city, I take the train in on the outskirts to the center of the city. And I'd get angry, and I feel like these were the trains that took the Jews to the camp. And he'd say to me, you know, you got to let go of the 6 million. And I'd say, yeah, Bill, but how about let's work the program, you know. And when he took me through the steps, you know, I could see that my life was unmanageable around food. You know, I went over to Spain. I had lost weight for the job interview. I got down to about 185. And when I met Bill, I was 265. And that's an embarrassing thing to be living overseas and to grow like that. And just a little bit of it is I couldn't buy pants in Spain big enough for me because the Spanish people weren't that big at that time. I don't know what they're like now. But if I had a business trip to England, I'd get a pair of pants. And that pair of pants, I'd only get one because I was going to lose weight. It was a problem. Wow. I keep having senior moments. I think it's because I'm over 60. But it's an action program. It all comes back to it's an action program. And took me through the steps. There we go. But I had a problem with God. Oh. Second step was came to believe that God could... Sure, God could, but why would he? You know? I mean, I had studied for 10 years a lot of spiritual stuff, you know, that my religious tradition. And several of the people that I read and thought unbelievably righteous stuff, they burnt and, you know, they went up in smoke. So if I was supposed to... third step, ask for God's will for me today on a daily basis? I didn't think so. If God's will for those people was that they should go up and smoke, I didn't want to know what God's will for me was. But he told me that I was going to have to figure a way around that, you know, because it's an experiential program that we don't read the big book and then when we're finished take a test and everything's better because we understand it. It's about doing it. And the example he gave me is like if you want to learn how to play tennis, you can read all the books you want, but you got to go play some tennis before you get good at it. And so what eventually I did was since I have no idea what God is, I always was jealous of Christians. Christians could look at God as Jesus Christ, as the human personification of God on earth, and therefore you could do whatever Jesus did, you could do what Jesus did. But me, in my religion, there's like 48 names of God, attributes, and so I know the attributes of God, but I don't know what it looks like. I don't understand it. I'm told, like, you know, that the blueprint for my religion is in the writings, but it's sort of like showing my dog the blueprints for the house. You know, my dog doesn't have the understanding necessarily to grasp, you know, the higher power here. So I have no understanding of God, and I just know that I didn't trust God, didn't trust anybody when I came in. And but for me, what I came up with was halfway great, thanks. Was just trying to do the next right action, You know, doing the next right action, and I'd ask God for help. But the way I learned to ask God for help, because I didn't trust God, was that when I was beaten to a pulp, which is in this program, I got to be 318 pounds after 2 years and 8 months of working this program as hard as I could. I had a guy who had 25 years in AA as my sponsor. I have a superior intellect. We all do, right? And so I thought with my intellectual understanding, I got the big book, I got a sponsor. I went to a meeting a day for the first 6 years, 8 years in program. It sounds a little daunting, but like here, if you're sitting here, you can go to three meetings today. I consider it a meeting, every speaker. And so I'd go to a lot of days in OA, I'd go to retreats. On Saturdays and Sundays, I could double up my meetings. Sometimes I'd have to go to a noon Al-Anon meeting because my sponsor was an alcoholic. It's true. I mean, no one's perfect. Oh, get into that. Yes, it's really important to have a sponsor. And, you know, I learned something really important about my sponsor. He would tell me about his stories. One of his stories was he worked construction in Saudi Arabia. And when he first came to Saudi Arabia, he saw some flies in the wall, and he's a lonely person. I'm the loneliest person in the world, and I'm my bottom line, and I'm not good enough at whatever it is I'm doing. Those are my two big things. And he was the loneliest person in the world. He's telling me these stories. I never understood why he was telling me these stories in the beginning. And there's a couple flies in the wall, and every time he'd come home from work, he talked to these flies because they were his pals. Okay, and he was there for 6 months, and he was still talking to the flies in the wall, as you know, at 6 months. And so I like to tell people that my sponsor talked to flies on the wall, and I got better. You know, and so you don't have to find the perfect sponsor to get better. You just have to find somebody who has what you want and take what you want and leave the rest. And so I had to go to Al-Anon to figure out what I was going to take and what I was going to leave. It wasn't necessarily easy, but he had something that I wanted, and he also had a behavior about him at times that wasn't right, and it was hard. Okay, so anyway, I got to I was stepping on the scale one day, and this was after I'd come to program. I was in program for 2 years, 8 months, and it ruins your reading. You know, I mean, you understand what you're doing, and it's not like totally unconscious. And I had eaten pasta. The way I used to cook pasta was I'd make a pot and then put it in a colander. I'd take out some for the whatever I was eating right now. And then when I wanted more, the colander it would solidify, so I would take a butter knife and I'd cut it into four pieces. And I'd stab one quarter of it and put it on my dish, take the cold tomato sauce and pour it on and go back to my wherever I was sitting and eat again, you know. And so I passed out. I thought I was tired because I was working hard, you know, and but I'd pass out after I eat. And when I'd wake up, I could see that my first thought was colander and tomato sauce. You know, I could see I was insane and that it was truly unmanageable. But I was always told to ask God for help, but I didn't believe God was going to help me, and I didn't trust God, and I was afraid that if I asked God for help and it didn't work for me, I would be hopeless. But at this point in time, for some reason, that passing out and stepping on the scale, I had one of these scales, well, this is a long time ago, I had one of these scales that had an arrow and a peg, and it was only going to go to 3 1/4. And then the arrow was going to stop, and I could see I was going to keep going. And I could see I was hopeless, and that I had tried it my way as best I could, and it wasn't working. So maybe I was going to have to take a risk and ask God for help. One of the things that really helped me with that choice is, you know, in the third edition, my favorite story is join the tribe. It's a real short story, and it's really just right on, just right on. And it's about an Indian who says he's got religion, but if he has to change for a better life, he's going to do it. That's when he hit his. You know, I could see that I had made that same kind of decision. I was going to jump off the cliff, as they say. I was just going to take the risk and see if I couldn't get better. And so I went on a protein-sparing modified fast. It's in those days, it's cow's hooves and noses ground up, mixed with water. You know, it was. I drank this crap for 8 months with no food, and then I had to come off and start eating real food. And so I'm going to a meeting a day. I have a sponsor. I've sponsored people from since I've been 3 weeks abstinent, and I haven't had a gap in the 22 years. Of a day without sponsoring somebody. I'm retired now, so I sponsor 7. And the idea being that I tithe my time to OA, you know, when you want to give charity, then a tithe. Anyway, boy, am I jumping around. So I guess I always fall back to action when I'm not sure where I am, because it is an action program. It's so I was willing to write my food down. Oh, that brought it back. I put it in a check register. I knew what my metabolism was. I'm an engineer. I knew what my metabolism was because I ate only 800 calories a day for 8 months. And so when you lose weight over a period of time and you're eating a certain amount of calories, you can tell how many calories per pound it takes to maintain your weight. And so I'd write these calories in a checkbook register. And another action that I was taking was exercise. You know, they had a thought of making exercise a tool. Yeah, I think that would have been a great idea, just me, but the majority, I guess, didn't. I found exercise to be really helpful. Exercise, really helpful. So I was out riding a bike. I ride a bike today. In fact, I've had both my hips replaced. I've had a number of things as a consequence of being morbidly obese. You know, I mean, I lost my gallbladder. I didn't lose it. They had to take it out. Both my hips are replaced within the last couple of years. In fact, this is the first full year after a portion of a year of recovery. I started, like I say, I write things down. So I started keeping track of the tandem miles my wife and I do. We ride a tandem bicycle. So this month, we've got 3,000 miles this month. We're averaging 300 miles a month. And the idea is that if I try and do 2.5 hours of exercise a week, there was a study done that showed people live better and healthier if they do 2.5 hours of exercise a week. Right? No, excuse me, 2,100 calories a week exercise. It doesn't matter if you walk, swim, play basketball, volleyball, jog, tennis, doesn't matter. Just as long as you do that. And I found it really helpful in my physical recovery, because to me, making amends to myself isn't being thin. I was morbidly obese. Morbid means like what? Near death? Right. So the idea, the opposite of morbid obesity is physical fitness. And so my living amends is to be physically fit. And yes, anyway, the action, when I came off the fast, I had made up my, I had to figure out what my abstinence was going to be. It was no fat, no salt, no sugar. It really was really important for me to pick out, to know what foods I couldn't eat one of. Thank God I had been in program for a while. So it was really easy. I couldn't eat one piece of pizza. I couldn't eat one submarine sandwich. So my abstinence right away was no bread, no flour, no processed carbohydrates, no sugar, of course. So I haven't had ice cream in 22 years, you know. There's products I haven't tasted. And thank God that I got into this before Costco. Because it would have been bad. So anyway, it's asking God for help. And it first came around the food. And, you know, my first prayer was asking God to help me not eat like an animal when I'd sit down and eat my meal. And I found that God helped me with doing the things that I had to do around being abstinent. I have a lot of spiritual literature, and some of it's programmed, some of it isn't, but I read literature before I eat, and I read it until I get to a place where I can sense God. And when I can sense that, then it's okay to eat, it's safe to eat. And I found that program is really it's inviting God into our lives and in every aspect of it. The first place I was willing to invite God in my life was around the food. And I mean, this will get you through the holidays if you invite God into your life, right? Another logistic kind of thing with the holidays was I would try and get into the spirit of the holiday. So if it was Christmas time, and even though I'm not Jewish, I would look into trying to be of service to people. If it was Thanksgiving, I looked to try and be grateful. And I'd try and carry those thoughts through the holiday season. But, I took the action of going to a meeting a day. I took the action of sponsoring people. I took the action of reading literature every day. And praying before the meal. My wife is a member of the program also. We have flowers on the table, and we have candles, and we have a nice, we have a beautiful setting. It reminds me, in a way, it's like you're supposed to, the whole idea of recovery is to elevate your character defects to a level of holiness. And the first way we practice it is with gluttony. So instead of being a glutton, if I sit down, instead of watching television when I eat, instead of eating while I'm moving around the room fixing it, if I wait and put my food on a table and I try and connect with the fact that God, this is a gift from God, and that I'm really just trying to eat enough to allow me to be of service in the world, it sounds good. I don't do it all the time, right? I mean, sometimes I like to eat because I want to eat. I like the taste of food. But there are a few times when I hit the ideal. I threw myself into studying the steps, you know, the decision to make. The third step is really just the decision to work my way through the steps. And I worked as hard as I could. And what I found was that it's really just training for a 10th step. The way that I stay in contact with God is 10, 11, and 12. 10 is really steps 1 through 9. If I'm constantly going to step meetings, if I'm constantly working with sponsees and working the steps, I get in touch with my character defects. And when I do that, I realize I need God's help with them, just like I needed with the food. I know when I got to be a year, I was told I shouldn't date until I was a year at goal weight. And I came into program, I was 38, I got divorced shortly after. I was 2 years, 8 months in program. I wasn't dating. And then it took me 8 months to lose my weight, and I wasn't dating. And then I waited a year and 4 months, and my first date was unbelievable. I was driving down Market Street in San Francisco towards the ferry building, and you can't take a left on Market Street. And I took this woman, we either went out to eat or we went to the movie, I forget, it's so long ago. And we were going to do the other thing next. And I was, woo, you know. Oh, okay, so I was beside myself, waiting to take a left at a no left. I see that, I can't take a left, so I went straight to the next light. Waiting to take a left where you can't take a left. I went to the third light, same thing. I said, I got to take you home, you know, because it's not about you. It's just, it was tough to process stuff. It takes a good time in the program, just learning how to get in touch with, it took me a long time, just learning how to get in touch with my feelings. But anyway, my best friend in program was my wife, but she wasn't my wife at the time. We were reading and writing 10 steps to each other, and within a group. There was a group of us who were a year or two abstinent, and things got really hard, and we were introduced to writing a 10-step. So she became my best friend, even though I didn't see her much, because she went to different meetings than I did. But I had a desk job, and she could call me during the day when she was wanted to read her 10-step. And so one day I got attracted to her on a physical level. I decided I wanted to date her. But I was afraid to move on that because my previous experience with dating was that if I had a physical relationship with a woman, not that I had that many, and then I stopped, I really didn't remain friends with this person. And I was kind of a lonely person, and she was my best friend. So I was kind of concerned that I don't know if I want to start moving in that direction. And it was wonderful. I had been at a day in OA, and one of these guys who was a star in OA at the time had 180-pound weight loss for 10 years. And there's a lot of sexual energy in the rooms, you know. He was talking about how when he was at retreats, he had to figure out, he would say, it's not enough to know what your character defect is. You have to practice the spiritual opposite of this. And so he was dealing with lust. Because when he was on these retreats, all these women would proposition him, and he was, hey, you know, he's thin, he used to be morbidly obese, now it's kind of fun to think of that, right? And so he was dealing with lust, and he suggested that the opposite of lust was purity of intent. And, does that mean anything to you? It didn't necessarily ring bells for me, but what he was telling me, he told a couple hundred people that purity of intent for him was if he knew the woman's name from yesterday, he could sleep with her today. And I said, oh, you know, my religion didn't say that was the acceptable thing. But it doesn't matter. What he was a mirror for me. You know, he let me see. It let me bounce my values off of that. Thanks, I see that. I've got to hurry up. So what I did was I went home and I wrote about what purity of intent meant for me. And purity of intent was that one of the Hebrew names for God, one of those attributes is makom, which means place. And so what you're supposed to realize what I'm supposed to realize as a Jewish person is that it doesn't matter what place I'm in, God's there. Okay? And so I called my wife, in my mind, I gave her a Hebrew name. And the Hebrew name is Batya, which means a daughter of God. And so for me, purity of intent was that if I realized God was standing in the room with me and his daughter, and I was willing to put my hand on her, then it would be okay. And things went really slowly. But it was probably the biggest growth experience I've had in program. I've never invited God into my life in a more intense way than that, even on the food. And what I've learned through that is that if I keep doing the things that I've been doing on a daily basis, keep trying to invite God into my life through working steps 10, 11, and 12, then it doesn't matter if it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's. You know, I'm going to still be able to be in touch with the spiritual feeling that fills the hole, that allows you to not have to eat in a way that's like an animal. And it's what keeps me coming back. You know, I do service at three different meetings, and I probably I average five meetings a day now that I don't need it so much. So, I mean, not a day, a week. Okay. So anyway, I appreciate a chance to share. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.